Okay. Okay, welcome back. I want to recap what I was doing last time because it's such a long, involved process. So, any questions about anything from last time? So remember, I was solving the vibrating string problem. In fact, I called it the harpsichord problem. And the problem was the wave equation. So let's see, this is the harpsichord problem. And the problem was the wave equation. So let's see, I had this string that I stretched out from 0 to pi. And the harpsichord gets plucked. And so I was going to pluck it right smack in the middle. So I pull the string and I let go. And the harpsichord problem, the displacement was described by u of x t, and that u satisfied the wave equation. Du dt squared equals du dx squared. And I described Johann Bernoulli's approach to this problem. He tried, so Johann's method, he tried u of xt, this is called separating variables, a function of x times a function of time. So he's looking for solutions of that special form because it's a PDE and he didn't know how to approach it. So he simplified the problem looking for solutions of a special form. And let's see, when I did that and plugged it in the PDE, then I got two ODEs, and they were this. X double prime over X equals T double prime over T equals lambda. And so the X problem by itself is when I combine it with the boundary conditions, so let's see, the x problem was x double prime, x double prime minus lambda x equals 0, and together with boundary conditions, x of 0 equals 0, and x of pi equals 0. Those boundary conditions were because the string needs to be pinned down at the endpoints. I solved that boundary problem, and the only time I could ever get anything that wasn't just the zero solution, I found that I must have lambda equal to minus n squared in order to get a non-zero solution. That involved quite a lot of playing around and pretty much ate up my whole hour playing around doing that. So I can only have certain values of lambda that will give me non-zero solutions. Okay, and so for that each lambda, let's see, for lambda equal minus n squared, I got, I'll call it xn of x, was sine n of x, n times x. When I did it the first time, I left a c there. But you remember, I absorbed that c into other constants so I could get rid of it. So I'm going to make that c be a 1. Okay. That was the most exciting stuff from last time. The x problem is hard because of those boundary conditions. The T problem is the same. And here's where I got a little bit rushed back and botched some things up. The T problem is exactly the same. T double prime minus lambda T equals 0. But no boundary conditions. So that's why I saved it, because it doesn't have the additional pain in the neck that those boundary conditions. So without boundary conditions, BCs. And so, let's see, when I plug it, when I let lambda be equal to minus n squared, then I get, I can solve that, and I get T of T equals, what did I call it? A n cosine n t plus B n sine n t. And so Johann Bernoulli found a solution that satisfies, let's see, call it U sub n of xt. I'm going to find infinitely many of them for n equals 1, 2, 3, etc. So the x function was sine nx, and the t function was an cosine nt plus bn sine nt. I should maybe underline that, because that's the big that's the thing. And you'll notice if I left my c in front of the sine nx, I could absorb it into the an and the bn. So I don't need to, I can get rid of that c. And now the Bernoulli realized, ha, I can add these together and get more solutions. And the question is, can I get enough solutions that I can also satisfy the other last thing to do, which was the initial condition? So the big idea is to try U of xt, a sum of those things. And here's where I got a little bit rushed at the end last time and botched something up. I fixed it in the notes that I post. So if you did notice something was botched up, it was fixed in the posted notes. Okay, so the great thing is that's a linear partial differential equation, so sums of solutions solve the problem. That's called the superposition principle. Also, those boundary conditions are homogeneous. They're 0 and 0. So all these things that satisfy them, that, when I add them up, they still satisfy. That's good news. So automatically, I've solved most of the problem. So the last thing we need, last thing, I'll call them things because there's two. There's two things I want. I want, let's see, here's what I botched up. I want U of x at time 0. I didn't put 0 there, I put t there, and it was that was a typo. I fixed it in the notes afterwards. So the initial condition, I want U of x at time 0. Let's see, when I plug that in up here, what is it? When I stick in cosine t, cosine of 0 is 1, so I get an's there. And the b's, let's see, the sine of 0 is 0. So those bn's are going to go away, and I'm left with a sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, an sine nx cosine nt. The other thing I need, before I plug it in, let's note that, this is one of the initial, I want this to be equal to f of x, which is the shape, TP-shaped function. Okay, and the other thing I want, let's look again at my f, my u of xt is that. If I take du by dt of that, let's calculate it. So if I take du by dt of x and t would be, let's see, when I differentiate cosine nt, an n would come out, and I'd get, minus n sine nt. And the derivative of sine nt would be n cosine nt. So when I do that partial derivative, I'd get the sum as n goes from 1 to infinity. This would be minus nan minus nan, the sine nx just sits there, and the derivative of cosine n, t would be, see, that's, I'm looking up here. The derivative of cosine nt would be, that's where the minus n came from, times sine nt. And the derivative of the other part would be nbn, sine nx just sits there, and the derivative of sine nt would be n cosine nt. So I just differentiated that stuff. And this is a t. So when I stick in t equals 0, which is the other initial condition, remember I was plucking it from rest. So d by dt at time 0, I'm holding it at rest and letting go. That's supposed to be 0. And so when I calculate that, that's the sum. Let's see, the sine nt is 0 when t is 0. So that part goes away, and I'm just left with this part. So this would be the sum as n goes from 1 to infinity of nbn sine nx cosine 0 is 1. And I want that to be to 0 because I'm... because I'm start plucking from rest. I can make that happen. I just have to take all the bn's equal to 0. So that's going to make life easier. Aha, so the aha here is take all the bn's equal to 0. And that greatly simplifies my solution. And so now I'm down to this. My solution is u of xt, when I plug it all back in, the bn's are gone now, so it's the sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, an, boy, that's annoying, isn't it? Cosine nt. So Bernoulli must have been getting pretty excited because this looks like a solution. But then he's got faced with the last problem is, I want that. Yeah, so there was a thing up here. I wanted that sum to be equal to my initial shape, f of x. And so how, doggone it, I did it again. When I put 0 in this, this is equal to 1. So, yeah. So my big problem, which is the problem of Fourier series, is this. Big problem given F, can we find coefficients an's so that the sum as n goes from 1 to infinity an sine nx equals f of x? And Bernoulli must have sat around and thought about that pretty hard for a while. These sine functions wiggle faster and faster, so I'm adding up things that wiggle faster and faster and hoping that maybe if I make the coefficient small, the wiggles will flatten out somehow and they'll add up to that thing, which is a straight ramp function. That doesn't seem terribly like something that might be possible, but it is possible and it's going to work. And here's the key. The key is that those functions, sine of nx, are orthogonal. Sine nx are all orthogonal on the interval from 0 to pi. And what that means is that, so this is a new kind of inner product, so I'll write it like this. Sine nx inner product with sine mx. So you've probably seen that notation for the inner product of functions. That's a new kind of inner product, and it's the integral from 0 to pi of the first function times the second function. That satisfies all the properties of a dot product of vectors. And the deal is that is, let's see, what is it equal to? I claim it's equal to 0 if n is unequal to m. And so let's see, to do that, you use the famous trig identity, which would turn this into a sum, sine times sine, sine alpha times sine beta is a sum of, I forget what it is, but it's like sine n minus m over 2x plus sine m plus m over 2x. So there's a trig identity, which turns those into sine functions, and then you can see very easily that that integral is going to be 0. If n is unequal to m. I'll probably do that when I get more time later. I don't want to sit around doing... my daughter's texting me, sorry. It's embarrassing. I don't want to do that right here, right now. But if n is equal to m, then this is equal to an integral from 0 to pi of a square. Sine squared nx. And of course, that's not 0. Because that's positive in most places. In fact, what is? I mean, I do know this trig identity. This is a famous integral you learn in freshman calculus. Let's see. Sine squared of an angle is a half times one. Is it plus or minus? It's got to be minus, because it's 0 at 0. So it's minus cosine 2 times nx. dx. And the integral of 2 cosine nx, that wiggles twice, so there's a hump above and a hump below, so those integrals cancel. So this, the integral of this part, 0, and I integrate a half from 0 to pi. I claim that's easy to see is equal to pi over 2. That's not 0. And so here's what Bernoulli thought. So the big idea is orthogonality. So let's think about it. If I really was able to write this as a sum, let's write it like this. A1 sine 1x plus A2 sine 2x plus dot, dot, dot. Multiply that by sine nx. So I'm going to multiply both sides by sine nx. When I integrate, I distribute these through and then integrate and sum the integrals when I integrate from 0 to pi. All those integrals would be 0, where that 2 is different than n, etc., except for 1 is not going to be 0. So when I integrate from 0 to pi, and do the same thing on this side, this is going to be equal to a sum now of an integral. I guess let's make this a sum of m going from 1 to infinity. Sine mx times sine nx dx. And all of those are 0, except for 1. So that's going to spit out, the one that's not 0 is an times the integral of that square. squared nx dx. And so here's the fantastic thing. That's just a number. That's just pi over 2. And so if this is possible and I can find such an an, here's what it has to be. So the aha, an has to be equal to 2 over pi integral from 0 to pi f of x sine nx dx. And that's the famous formula. So this Fourier gets all the credit for this formula. It was Bernoulli who actually did it well in advance. And he doesn't get credit for it. Funny thing, if you think of mathematicians as a family tree, think of my father as being my PhD thesis advisor. My thesis advisor was Norberto Kurtzman, and his thesis advisor was Louis Nirenberg. And you go up, up, up. Johann Bernoulli is in my family tree. It's cool. There's a math genealogy project. It makes your family tree in math. So you start following my advisors, then go up, up, up. You'll hit Euler. Euler was a student of the Bernoullis. And then Johann Bernoulli, and then Johann Bernoulli's advisor was his father, Jakob. And then there's not many records before that, sort of the birth of this stuff. So you might say that Fourier series is in my blood. And actually, Fourier's in the family tree, too. So Fourier is a couple generations down from Euler. And he's in my tree also. I'm going to show you a demo here in a second using Maple that you calculate these ANs and see if they work, and they're going to work numerically. So it's exciting to see that they're going to work numerically. Bernoulli couldn't show that back then, and so he wasn't so confident that he had a formula for it and it might work, but he'd have to somehow show that this is actually going to converge to the function he wanted. So let's see, what should I do here? Oh, let me show you. I want to give you a feeling for what these functions are. So let's call these modes of vibration. So remember, I'm solving a string problem. So this is related to music. I should put this in a red box. Because this is going to be the answer. I have that big sum, and if I choose the coefficients to be that, that's going to be the answer. So let me talk about these modes of oscillations. Modes of oscillation. So let's see, how about, so for each n, I had a un. Un of xt was equal to sine nx cosine nt. Now, if n is equal to 1, here's how to think about that. I've got from 0 to pi. The sine nx function would look like, let's see, that'd be sine times 1x. So sine times 1x looks like this. So it's just one hump of the sine function. That's sine of x. And at time t equals 0, cosine 0 is 1. So at time 0, it's that green thing. But then a cosine kicks in and starts shrinking. So this is going to be sine of x times cosine t, and it starts shrinking, and so that's going to shrink it. Cosine multiplying by cosine t shrinks it, and then let's see, at some point cosine is going to be 0. That's going to give me something 0. And then cosine goes negative after that. And so it's going to go bulge down now. And when cosine is minus 1, it's that. So let's say I'm multiplying by cosine t. Yeah, so this That bottom thing is the minus sign function. So what I'm graphing here is sine of x times cosine t. When cosine is 1, I'm on the top green thing. And then cosine starts shrinking. And when cosine is 0, when t makes that 0, let's see, that would happen at what? Pi over 2. I'd be that red line. And then it goes negative, and that would bulge this out. And when it's equal to minus 1, it would be the bottom sign. And then it goes back and forth and does that over and over again. So if you ever plucked a guitar string in a strobe light, or even in 60 cycle per second light, that's what it looks like. I'm going to convince you in a second that that's not all. There's more stuff in there than just that. It's so small you don't really see it, but it's there. Then if I do, let's do n equal 2. Let's see, I've got my same 0 to pi. This is going to be sine 2x times cosine 2t. The cosine 2t means it wiggles twice as fast. And let's see, sine 2x looks like this. It's one hump up and one hump down. And then the cosine kicks in. That's going to shrink it. And so over here, it's going to shrink it this way. Then it's going to shrink it some more. And then when cosine is 0, it's going to be flat. And then when cosine goes negative, it's going to bulge it out the other way. Like that. And then when cosine is minus 1, it's going to be this. I should have used a different color. And if you've ever plucked a guitar string and just very gently touch it right in the middle, then you cut out this motion. And how many people have done that? Yeah, what happens?
When you do that, like
it plays a note exactly one octave higher. It doubles the frequency.
Right.
It doubles the frequency so that it goes up an octave. But it's a quiet sound. So you pluck the thing and it's loud, and then you just gently touch the string and right in the middle, and it cuts out that solution and leaves you with this solution. And this bounces up an octave, and you hear an octave but kind of faint. I wish I brought a guitar to class. And interesting, the next one, n equals 3, I'll do it quick, this would have three humps. Let's see, so sine 3x would look like this, and multiplying by cosine, it would shrink it, then it would be 0, then when it goes negative, it would bulge it below the x-axis. And then when it's minus 1, it would max out and look like that. So that's sine 3x cosine 3t. And that's wiggling 3 times faster. And if you wanted to do the experiment on a guitar, you'd touch it right here at the 1/3 mark. And that would cut out that sound, and this would be an octave and a fifth higher. Yeah, I'm going to show you the notes here in a minute. So et cetera, I can do more of those. And on a musical scale, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here's the treble clef, here's the bass clef. Let's take the n equals, let's take this to be n equal 1, this would be a low C. Let's say I've got a really flabby low string. So that's a low C. That corresponds to n equal 1. The next one, when I touch the string right in the middle, then it would bounce up to the C above that. So that would be a C n equals 2. If I were to touch it right at a third, then I would get the G above that. Here's a G. So that would be a G, and that's n equals 3. Then if I touched it at a fourth, that 4 is 2 times 2. So that would double the frequency twice. So that'd go up one octave and another octave. So two octave up, upright is right here. This is another C, and that corresponds to N equal 4. And then they start getting closer and closer together. The next one is an E. The next one's a G. So E, G. And the next one is kind of a crummy sounding B flat. And then the next one's a C, then a D, and then an E, and then an F, and a G. And they start getting really close together. That's called the harmonic sequence. And I don't have a guitar, but I do have this thing. So this this is a euphonium, and this is a cylindrical column of air, and it satisfies exactly the same wave equation and has the same boundary conditions. And the interesting thing is, I can only make this column of air vibrate at certain frequencies. If I try to make it vibrate in between some of those notes, I can... jumps. I can't force it to vibrate in between those things. So this is the harmonic sequence. So I want to try to play that really low C. I'm not pushing any vowels. The very lowest note is, it's going to sound terrible. Let's see if I can get it. That's not it. That's the fundamental pitch of this thing. So that's when I don't cut out any of the, when I don't touch it in the middle, I don't cut out that fundamental pitch. That's the fundamental pitch of the horn. It's kind of a crappy sounding note and it's never used. The next one, when I go up an octave, that would be this one. So that's that C right there. Then, the next one would be going up a fifth. So now I'm up to that C there, and then they start getting closer and closer together. That's up to the G, and now that's kind of a crummy B flat. And then they start getting really close together. Play a scale if I had to, except I'd probably have a stroke and die. Back in the time of Bach, they didn't have valves, and so they played trumpets with really small mouthpieces, and all those close together notes meant they could get a full scale. And so it was called Al Clarino. And they could play all those notes that were close together. And if you play French horn, they very often are playing in that range where all the notes are really close together. That's why French horn players miss a lot of notes. It's hard to distinguish those notes. So that, as long as I got a euphonium in my hands, so I have that sequence of notes I can play by not pushing any vowels. If I push this middle vowels, it adds a little piece of pipe to it, which makes it go a half a step lower. So I have this sequence. I push the first valve, it adds a little more pipe. If I push one and two, it adds more pipe. And all I need are three valves, really, to get all the notes in the scale. So that's seven combinations. The fourth valve makes some certain notes in better tune, so it's useful. Anyway, that's back when I was undergrad, I thought maybe I wanted to study musical acoustics so I could design the next baritone horn. But that's a euphony. But it turned out it was the math I liked more than the engineering part. But here's the fascinating thing. All those notes I was playing are present in the vibrating string. If you want to see, if you want to just hear the piece of the series that corresponds to, if you just want to hear the piece that corresponds to, say, that the one with N equal 4, you touch it in that spot and it would cut out all the other ones and you just hear that one. So you can actually find those coefficients by poking your finger on the thing. And it's interesting to experiment. And the euphonium is exactly the same blend of notes. And the only difference between a euphonium and a saxophone are the relative size of those coefficients. So if you can, that's what was so exciting about Bernoulli's solution here is that it leads to synthesizing signals. I can synthesize music now because of Bernoulli. Jacob's solution didn't allow me to do that. But now if an oscilloscope, you spin a circular thing around in a magnetic field, you make a sine wave sound, an oscilloscope. And so now if I can make those basic waves and combine them together, I could synthesize the euphonium sound. But if I knew what the Fourier coefficients should be. So if I blend them together with just, the AN is certainly big, the next A2, A1 is big, because that's the fundamental sound, and A2 would be smaller. There's these numbers that I could find, and I could synthesize the euphonium sound. And a flute sound would be different numbers, a clarinet sound would be different. But that's the only difference between clarinet, flute, trumpet, trombone, is the blend of these basic pitches when you put them together. It's fascinating that, cylinder instruments like trombones, clarinets, they're more piercing and bright. Turns out that every other number in the sequence is zero. So only 1, 3, 5, etc., yeah?
So, but that would only give you the tone, right?
It's called the timbre, I guess. It would give you the feeling of, right, and so it's the attack that really, you can say, aha, that's a trumpet. If somebody plays a trumpet but you don't hear the attack, you can say, is that a trumpet or a saxophone?
Yeah.
Sometimes. But actually, saxophone is quite different than trumpet. Saxophone is a cone-shaped instrument, so it has a full sequence. All the A's are non-zero. But a trumpet is a cylinder, and it has only the odd ones being non-zero. All the even coefficients are zero. And that's what makes some, like trombones and trumpets, it makes them more intense and piercing, because the euphonium has a full blend, and so it sounds kind of more mushy and mellow, whereas trombones and trumpets have every other one, which makes it much more piercing and intense. That's cool. Do I have time to play around with some maple? I think it's kind of fun. Yeah, let's think about some maple here for a second. Have people played around with maple? It's on every PC on campus, so if you go to a ITAP machine and type maple in the search, you'll find maple 2016. Okay, so I'm going to use some maple commands. This thing with plots, put a semicolon and then push return. It loads all these commands, and one of the commands I really like is animate. That's cool. I want animate and a couple other ones. If you don't want to see the output of a command, instead of putting semicolon, you put a colon. All right. It turns out that the Fourier series of the solution to my problem, S of X equals the harpsichord thing, they alternate in sign, so they go plus, minus, and they're the odd number squared. So it's 1 over 1 squared, minus 1 over 3 squared, 1 over 5 squared, minus 1 over 7 squared. So let's see, I'm going to input, I'll push return here. That's the Fourier series. That's the Fourier series for the harpsichord thing. And so, if I were to write them out, I wish I'd written them out on a piece of paper so you could see them beforehand. But I'm going to convince you right now that they do converge to... I'm going to plot them. There it is. And that's cool. This remember, these are sine things that we're going about. I only sell them to 10. And this looks completely straight right here. It's a little bit wiggly right there, and it's kind of a smooth corner. But it sure it does look like that harpsichord thing. Let me now change the number in the sum. How about if I go, there's n equal 1 to 10. Why don't I sum, how about 20? Okay, I push return, that'll run that again. And then I'll plot it again. It's much pointier now. And if I made it 30, it would look straighter and pointier there. I could never make it be 100% pointy, because but it converges to the pointiness. So if I let n go to infinity, the solution is fantastic here. And the error is very small. There's a very slight error at the point, and you have to live with that. That's the, in Fourier analysis, pointy things are going to give you slow convergence. You get super fast convergence where the smooth spots are. Okay, so that's if Bernoulli, if Johann could have shoved that in front of his dad's nose, he would have gotten some credit for this. And now I'm going to have a function of two variables. So this is u. This colon equals means I'm defining the function. So u colon equals is defined, and it's going to take x comma t. This is like an arrow. It's hyphen greater than sign. So that's like an arrow of maps to. Xt maps to a sum, and I've got a formula for the coefficients. They're the odd number squared alternating in sign. That's the sine functions here. And remember, we multiply by the same cosine nt. So these are only the odd numbers, and we're multiplying by the same cosine odd number t, and we're dividing by the odd number squared, and they're alternating plus or minus. So that is the function of, that's the solution to the wave equation. And now I'm going to animate it. So this animate command, I'm taking the function u of xt, and x is going to go from 0 to pi, and the animation variable is t, and I'm going to make it go from 0 to 2 pi. So it's going to give me snapshots as t is going to be various things as you move along from 0 to 2 pi. It's going to graph the x function. Let's see what happens. It's going to start, so this is like a little player. That's the first frame. Let's see, how should I play it? I'm going to play it. That's what it does. And that really is what it does. I'm going to put it into a loop. Can I do that? Where's my loop? Oh yeah, here's the loop. I'm going to put it into a repeating loop. I'm going to slow it down. Frames per second. And that kinky spot, it propagates. So you'll notice it splits and it goes apart, and then they come back, they actually reflect off that kink that's coming here. It reflects off here and then follows it back down and repeats that. So it actually, Jakob's solution of these two waves that are passing each other, that shows the way that the kink propagates and gives you that sort of feeling of reflection about the edges there. We're going to understand the problem from that point of view later. But this really is how a string vibrates, and Johann nailed it. Questions about that? That pointy thing is not very great. If I wanted to make it better, I would add more terms. I think I only have 10 terms in the series. Yeah, I only went out to 10. If I wanted to take more computing time, I would take it out to 30 or more, and it would be a nicer, cleaner thing. I can also specify the number of grid points to use that sort of cleans up graphs sometimes. As long as I've got Maple going here, an interesting problem is the vibrating membrane. And a vibrating square membrane, here's going to be a vibrating square membrane. Uh-oh. Am I going to crash Maple? This never happened before. Oh, crap. What did I do? I animated that. So this is Animate 3D. There's nothing wrong with this. Looks like I hung up maple, so... let's see if I... Nope, it's dead. So I will switch to back to this thing. So here's what I should have written down before I did that. So you can calculate the ANs. So that's a fun thing to do with Maple too, because Maple can integrate integrals real nicely. But the ANs turn out to be this. A1 is 1 over 1 squared. A2 is 0 when you calculate it. A3 is minus 1 over 3 squared. A4 is 0, and you see the pattern. A5 is 1 over 5 squared, etc. And so the solution I get to the harpsichord problem is u of x t equals sine x cosine t minus 1 over 3 squared sine 3x cosine 3t plus 1 over 5 squared sine 5x cosine 5t minus dot dot dot. And notice these 1 over something squared, those go to 0 really fast. So in fact, your ear doesn't hear these very weak sounds. Your ear doesn't hear the tail end of that series. So Bernoulli's solution is actually useful from the point of view of music. Your ear can't hear those high frequencies, so chuck them out, and this is what you hear. And so actually plucking a harpsichord in the middle is a bad idea. This is kind of a boring sound. If you were to play this blend it on an oscilloscope, this would sound like a plucked rubber band, kind of. So it's not that's why nobody would pluck a guitar right smack in the middle. That makes it sound boring and drab. If you want a much more interesting sound, you would pluck closer to an end. And in fact, piano hammers are very close to the end of the string for exactly that reason. It makes it sound much more interesting, and it makes sure that all the coefficients come in. You don't get these gaps with zeros, and it makes it sound more interesting. And in fact, the most interesting sound happens when you take an irrational multiple of the string length. Because you know those spots, 1/3, 1/4, etc., those spots are rational points. And if you hit the hammer there, you're going to activate one of those things and kill the other one. So if you want to activate them all and not kill any single one of them, a better place would be to pick an irrational number. Of course, people can't really make an irrational number, and pianos are highly imperfect, especially the hammer part. So you tend to get all the harmonics in there, but you get a much more interesting sound by whacking the string near the end, and it actually not 1/16, not 1/20, but a whacking number it's not any of those basic ones, and you get a much more interesting sound. Question?
Is there anything special about like a golden ratio? Do they ever consider like, is that like a special thing where you like make the ratio like?
I'm not thinking it comes up in this musical discussion. It'd be interesting to have the most beautiful musical instrument there is. I'm going to think about that. Okay, well, that feels like enough for today. And so now that the fun's over, next time we're going to start getting down to business of calculating these things and looking at them more carefully. And we can actually show that these things converge to what I say they are. And they converge really fast at the smooth spots, and they converge but slower at the kinks. And we'll actually see that kind of stuff.
What? I don't know.